Hello and thanks for listening to RTÉ Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast with me, Aoife Nic Cormick. This episode features musicians Martin Hayes and Steve Cooney in a public interview recorded at a symposium called Trad Talk, which took place in Dublin Castle in late 2019. Hello and welcome to The Rolling Wave. Today's programme is coming to you from Trad Talk, a symposium organised by the recently formed Trad Éireann. And their hope for today is to explore what opportunities there are within the traditional arts. And The Rolling Wave is delighted to have been invited to take part in that conversation. So to that end, I'm joined by two of our very finest musicians, both of whom have made music their lives for many years now, and both of them have made an enormous contribution in different ways to Irish traditional music. So please give a very warm welcome to Steve Cooney and Martin Hayes.
Yes.
The deceptively simple The Breeches Full of Stitches played there by Steve Cooney and Martin Hayes. Martin, we've a lot of things to cover in the next sort of 40 minutes or so, but to give a context maybe on your pathways into music, I mean, you were fortunate enough to have been born into traditional music. There was your father, Pete O'Hayes, there was your uncle, Paddy Canny, and many of their friends. But was it always obvious to you, or was there always a thing that this would be your life, or that you'd want to make this your life?
Well, it was always obvious, I mean, from when I was young, that music would be the most important part of my life. In that sense, I, at least I identified in that way. Now, however, being a professional musician was nothing short of failure in life, and so I had no plan for that. And I heard a recent interview with Philip Glass where they asked him for any advice for young musicians, and he says, well, don't do it unless you can't do anything else. You know, I mean, it's because, but really, I think I need to explain that a little further, which is what he meant by don't do it unless you. The idea being that if you can't live without doing this, don't do it. I mean, because it'll require of you incredible dedication, passion, and resourcefulness, and, you know, it's kind of staying the course. So you better get a lot of nourishment from the music itself, or you won't be able to continue. But apart from that, it's great. Yeah, absolutely.
Steve Cooney, you also had music at home. I think you told me your dad was a very good guitar player, but your sort of pathway into music was a bit more complicated and maybe a bit more sort of deliberate or forced by circumstance.
Yeah, well, I think it's always best for kids to get music in the home. If a parent can pass on music to their children, whether it's professional or not, if they can get it in the home, it's the, because it's that early learning when you absorb it more. So we got it at home. I was the youngest of five. My dad was a guitar player. So we all used to sit around and play. And also, the family was Methodists. And the thing about the Methodists, of all the Protestant denominations, the Methodists consider themselves or ourselves as the best hymn singers, you see. And in church, everyone is expected to sing harmony. It's a part of a communal kind of effort. So every Sunday, it's church or Sunday school, you'd be learning harmony. You'd have to sing. And I think that's where I learned kind of harmony. And then I had an elder brother who had a Mary O'Hara record, Love Songs of Ireland. So I think when I was probably nine, this record came out, and that was the first time I heard Irish music. And so I think it has still informed my sense of accompaniment of Irish music was Mary O'Hara. And I was shocked when I came to Ireland to find that among the cool traditional musicians, Mary O'Hara wasn't really considered the apex. And to hear people laugh now confirms that opinion. Because to me, she was just one of the greatest accompanists of song ever. And her sensitivity and inventiveness, she was really amazing. Anyway, so that's all I knew of Irish music at all. But you see, in Australia, for political reasons, Australia sent troops to Vietnam and there was conscription. So when you were 19, you had to make a choice to leave the country or face conscription and go to Vietnam. And on one hand, every Friday at school, we'd be learning in military cadets how to bayonet people to death. And then on the other hand, I'm going home and I'm playing the Beatles, "All You Need Is Love." And it's the kind of the dichotomy of society at that time, anti-communist, pro-Vietnam War, or anti-Vietnam War, pro-peace and love and hippies, and playing music. So you were forced to choose one side or the other. So I chose the side of music and left school and left the country until conscription was over. So that kind of set you on that path.
I think you told me you were going to be studying microbiology and law. Is that right?
Strange combination.
That would have been our loss, I think.
Strange combination.
So the trip then, you came to Ireland.
No, for some reason, I don't know why. Ireland was never on my radar. It was in those days, it used to be ships, Greek ships or Italian ships would circumnavigate the world, and you bought a round-the-world ticket, and you got on, and then you got off wherever you wanted to. So I got off in America for a while and got off in England for a while. And when the war was over, I came back to Australia and started work as a studio musician. And we kind of considered ourselves a bit of an elite because our job was to learn things very fast and execute them very fast. And then I wanted to learn didgeridoo because I thought if I'm an Australian musician, I should learn the Australian instrument. So I went to the Northern Territory to learn didgeridoo from an Aboriginal tribal group, and that wound up me became inducted into the tribe. I went through initiation, tribal scars, etc. Then they said to me, "You know, how do you expect to understand our culture? You don't even understand your own culture. Go back to the land of your ancestors and learn Changa Kyol Filiacht Rinkagus Triacht."
So they set you a challenge.
Yeah, five things to do. And then 14 years later, and amazingly, there was in that synchronistic world, it's very mystical, but all of a sudden I started meeting Irish musicians, and a student brought me Planxty's Blacksmith to work out. And I had always, when I was teaching, my ego always prided itself on the fact that I could hear a track, work out what the guitar player was doing, write it down, and teach the student how to do it all in 2 hours. And I heard the Planxty's Blacksmith with Andy Irvine's mandolin and Donald's bouzouki, this interweaving. I never heard the likes of it. I said, "Well, I'm a bit busy today, Paul, so just leave it with me and come back next week." And when he had gone, I said, "My God, what is this?" You know. And so it was immediately after the Aborigines sent me the challenge to go to Ireland. Suddenly my intellect was provoked in that direction, and I met Irish musicians. So then I left Australia and got there. I didn't want to learn Irish music in Australia because to me, like, music is what comes out of the land. I just wanted to get onto the land. So, Shinamash Gaelsa. So that's it.
Mm. So Steve left his home and came here, and you left your home and went to the States, Martin. Why did you go, and was it because of music or because of work, or what was the reason?
Well, I didn't really have a plan to go. I just kind of, the real story is that there was these friends of mine down in Kilkishan, two brothers, Christy Carey and Gerard Carey. And they had a little group, and they were in the Taliban doing a tour in America. And Jerry met a woman in Chicago, no, in New York. And I didn't really know. So, like, he called me up a few months after the tour. He says, "I'd like to go back again and do another tour with this group." And I was going, "Well, I don't know." You know, and he says, "My brother says he'll go if you'll go." I was going, "All right, okay, I go." And then I found out that he had done the same with his brother. He says, "Martin says he'll go if you'll go." And so anyway, he talked us in. Now, he's a happily married man living in Chicago, and it was the right thing for him to do, clearly. But the byproduct was that I ended up touring around America for 3 months. And I suppose in reality, I didn't have anything happening here at the time. I was recovering from a broken ankle, and there wasn't much happening. So I just stayed there. And so 26 years later, you know, I mean, time passed. But it was quite an experience, I suppose. I actually matured as an adult in America, so most of my adult life was living there.
How old were you when you went there?
I was 21, I think. Yeah, so I ended up in Chicago, and that was a great city of music, of all kinds of music, jazz and blues, and traditional music. There was a huge community of traditional musicians, and I got very involved in organizing sessions and things soon after I got there. And when I got there, there was the Irish Musicians Association of Chicago, and it was all these, what at that time for me were older musicians, Johnny McGreevy and all these great players, and they had like a scene going on there. They actually kind of looked out for me a little bit and kind of set up music classes for me to teach, which I had never done before. And I was like, absolutely. I remember the first poor students that had to encounter my idea of teaching music. I mean, kind of teaching is something you learn. And so I had to start out on these poor guinea pigs. And so I did teach them something, I think. You know, I'm not sure how far that really
went. Have you met them since?
I have, yeah. They come to gigs. I taught them that they wanted to hear it anyway, you know, and they kept coming back. So some of them do play sessions still. And so I got to meet Liz Carroll there and Marty Fahey and John Williams and all those musicians too, and lots of other musicians from different backgrounds and genres as well.
And living as a full-time musician in the States, what was it like to live there as a full-time musician? Were there supports there? Were there things there that helped that maybe we don't have here or didn't have here at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to earlier panel discussions here about, you know, lots of art support and stuff like that. There's very little official art support in America. There's a lot of philanthropy, however, available. But mostly, musicians actually exist in the free market of people turning up at the door and paying. And I became quite aware of the, you know, you're a bit of an entrepreneur as well as a musician in a sense. And my first involvement in that was playing pubs and clubs in Chicago, where I was playing really music that had no meaning to me whatsoever. Things like the Black Velvet Band, things to survive. And but in that process, I learned how to utterly manipulate an audience. And that was the lesson, like, because I had to eventually learn to never do that again, to not actually engage in that trickery, to only allow music to speak, if at all possible. I mean, I did learn some stagecraft and skill and some ability to communicate, I suppose, in the process. But there was in those pubs and clubs and cabaret rooms, it was kind of like, You learn the dark arts of the stage, and so never to be revisited, really, you know, if at all possible.
So, Steve, while Martin was playing cabarets and clubs, you had come to Ireland. Was your first introduction into it was sessions, I presume, was it?
Sessions, but I learned very quickly that guitar players weren't necessarily welcome in sessions. That was my first. So I had to negotiate the politics of being a guitar player, which is being an accompanist, which is being a backer, which has exposed me to the hierarchical nature of Irish traditional music. And which is, in terms of the evolution of Irish music, it's great to see how things have changed. And I remember Lara Somaroku said to me at one stage, a good few years ago, the guitar didn't used to be accepted or allowed, I forget what he said, in Irish music, but it has been shown to work, so now it is accepted. I remember Mark Kelly from Altan was the first guitarist to be allowed to play with Coulter's Kjolthor Éireann. And I understood why, but the bouzouki made it into Irish music as a legitimate instrument before the guitar, which is strange because it was being played as a Dublin society instrument in the 1600s. So the guitar's been here a long time. So I kind of had to think about that, but what I realized was during the ballad boom, people had learned a few chords and they were singing their songs, and then when it came to tunes, they would play the same few chords with the tunes, and melody players would get annoyed with them for playing the wrong chords and that kind of stuff, so perhaps they got a wee bit of a bad name. But I have an image in my brain. It's somewhere in Dublin, in a pub in Dublin, and I can see the fiddle player flaking away sweat running down his face, and the guitar player timidly tipping away, because there was this thing of, we want you there, but we really don't want to hear what you're doing. And Australians just wouldn't... I'm not going to do that. Like, there's a very uncompromising thing about Australians. Like, we play rock and roll, we play hard, because we had to play hard growing up. And sure, you play sensitively, but I couldn't do that. I couldn't just sit back and be anonymous, because to me, energy is meant to be shared. We have to hit the same energy. If you're playing with I don't mind the term accompanist, but I reject the term backer, because it implies this hierarchy of musicianship, and I just couldn't accept that. But that's why I loved it when I went to Kerry, West Kerry, because it was the first time, no matter how hard you played, it was never going to be hard enough. I suppose there's a couple of Kerrymen in the audience. I see Dahi Kearney and Danny Mahoney here, so there's a couple of Kiri Ochancha, and they would appreciate full well that it's to do with the dancing. And I suppose when I went to Kerry, I just shouldn't say why I went to Kerry, because I couldn't make a living in Dublin. I was living in Fairview on the north side. I was cycling. I had one gig a week with Jerry O'Banjo O'Connor in the Mount Pleasant Inn in Rathmines. And I would cycle from Fairview across town in the driving cold winter rain with my guitar on my back to do this one gig for 20 quid a week or something. It just wasn't a good existence, and I just couldn't make a living here. But I knew the Begleys in West Kerry, so I said I had gone to Kerry actually to write a book on teaching music to children, because I had developed a system of a methodology of notation which I wanted to teach kids. So I went to Kerry to write this book, started playing with Seamus at Begley, and we started doing gigs, and all of a sudden began to make a living for the first time in all my years in Ireland. But the thing about the Kerry music was it's dance music, and I realized that session music has become divorced from dance music. They're dance tunes, but you dare not play them as you would for dancers. Like, can I just give you a wee example? Like the Kerry polka, if you listen to the dancers' feet, you hear. And that is the pulse of what you're listening to. So I began to incorporate those rhythms. And when we'd play in Clare and for the playing set, I would hear the rhythm of listening to the floor. You hear. And that's what I'm hearing from the dancers' feet. But if you went into a session, a pub session, and played those rhythms, would you stop that syncopation now? You know, so I think there's been a divorce or a disconnect between the dance music and the session music. And that's what I loved about Kerry. Playing for dancers was a complete education and brought me home to the heart of the music.
We're going to talk in a minute about the nuts and bolts of things that could be done to help musicians, because that's the reason for this seminar today. But one of the things I think, one of the core issues which it all boils down to, is how we as a state or as a society value musicians and music. And that has come up before this morning. Because I think it's fair to say that we're very good in this country at celebrating musicians at big events and sort of spectacles, relying on them indeed when there are big events. But in the quiet times, maybe we don't do enough. Do we value our musicians enough here, do you think, Martin?
Well, I would think in terms of traditional music that musicians are more valued and recognised and embraced now than they have been for a really, really long time. I think you'd have to go into ancient history to actually find a time when it would be more acceptable to be a traditional musician. Having said that, I mean, there was a lot of talk about funding there. I mean, the real truth is that through successive governments here, arts funding is about one-third of the average of European countries. So it needs to be not doubled, but tripled. It needs to be much greater. And I'm not blaming anybody for that. But then there was also talk about philanthropy and the models that they have in America, in which the arts are supported by philanthropists. But that's a taxation issue as well, because those people are allowed, you know, to write this off, their taxes, when they support the arts. So if the government is still somewhere between Brussels and Boston, they can have the Arts Council funding, but for the remainder, two-thirds of this, they should at least do something with the taxation system of corporations and allow them, allow Apple and allow other people to actually support the arts here. I mean, they need the tax breaks, you understand? So.
But listening earlier, I mean, we were listening to people who are undertaking residencies and things like that in Ireland for various institutions, and that's great because that buys you time to immerse yourself in your art and your music. But is there a sort of a problem with how we view the work that artists and musicians do? We always award success or we award fund projects, not always because of the residencies and other things. Whereas failure or a period of quiet or, you know, time to experiment and all those things, that's crucial because that's how you get to the good stuff.
Well, I think that, you know, they have this thing they say in America when they get government involved in something, they talk about, well, you can't get involved in picking winners and losers. And so when you do have funding, you are actually, in some sense, picking winners and losers. You're saying, money for this, not for that, I'm sorry. Money for this, not for that. There ought to be ways in which funding can be available. Like, I can imagine if there were publicly funded recording studios, for example, that were simply available to all people to try out. Or if there were actually publicly funded or through philanthropy or whatever, like actual residencies, like available, you know, on a rotation that didn't require, you know, too strenuous of entry level. I mean, like if it's going to be a music residency, you at least need to be able to play, you know. But beyond that, I mean, the thing is, you know, people need the opportunities. And as somebody rightly pointed out, when people gain a residency here, they gain confidence. And confidence is nine-tenths of the game here in terms of people advancing with their careers and their music and their belief in what they do. And so creating opportunities where many more people at least have an opening and an opportunity to begin that process. I mean, it's quite possible, like, the musicians of the residencies here are all very well accomplished musicians already in a sense, and I think it's great that they have it, but I would also like to see, you know, people who are not necessarily that accomplished be given the space, you know, the space to work in music, if that is possible in a kind of a non-picking of winners and losers.
I think there is a place for everybody in an ensemble of music. You don't have to be, not everybody in the group has to be pyrotechnically brilliant. You can just sit there and keep the clock ticking over, like, you know. So it's just how much, it's really, the thing about Irish music I love is it doesn't matter how technically advanced you are, it's how much heart and soul, how much empathy you have for the music. Because I remember I tried to learn, you know, progressive jazz music through my 20s, and I just couldn't get the chops together. But when I realized Irish music, it was constructed by farmers, and they couldn't be practicing 21 hours a day. They had just could only play when they could. And so the technique of Irish music is not hugely advanced, but it's all to do with how much heart and soul you play with it. And Martin is a perfect example of that.
Martin, you were named as a cultural ambassador for Ireland in January, I think. It was part of the Irish government's Global Ireland 2025 scheme. And on the one hand, it's great because it's recognising and acknowledging your huge cultural contribution. But should that go further now? Should it be developed? I know Philip King, in an interview recently, spoke about that thing of soft power, the value of sentiment, reputation, all that. And that's great. But do you need something more concrete to make things happen?
That's a very good question. I mean, when I was offered this position, my first question was, what do I have to do? And because I didn't want to take on too much, to be honest with you, and because I'm busy enough. And so they said, we basically want you to continue doing what you're doing. And of course, my life is a life of traveling and music and performance, as it is for Oisin and John and lots of other musicians here, where we bring this music around the world. And I'm I think rightfully very proud of this music, and I think it occupies a particular place that Steve was addressing there, in a sense, because it is not the most complex form, but it's a form of incredible common sense and directness and clarity and emotional depth and resonance and understandability across all kinds of cultural barriers. So it's a hugely powerful form of music that connects us to a wide world. I mean, whether it's in Japan or China or India or wherever you travel in the world, it is possible for this music to reach people at a soul level, at least, and in their hearts. And so in that sense, like, the ambassadorial kind of element of it, I think, is something we are all doing when we travel and tour and perform. And I think if I have one imagined role, it's maybe to, if I can speak out in terms of what I think traditional music needs here, because it needs to be supported here in order for it to actually travel the world well. So it needs to have the funding and the support of the government.
From the home base.
Yes, I think so, yeah. And I think if there was some concern that the arts funding wouldn't be doubled, I think we need to talk about tripling it so that it might potentially be doubled. You know?
Ask for more and then,
yes,
yeah.
Something like that.
Steve, we were talking, looking back over your careers in music, and we were talking about things that have changed positively, say for somebody starting out. And I know you mentioned university education and the way that traditional music is now in place in so many of the universities.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant to see what the late Micheál O'Sullivan did at UCC, and then setting up University of Limerick, the World Academy there, and CIT, Cork, Dundalk now. You can just see that people can go out of secondary education, play a bit of music, and then do a master's in traditional music, which is great. Although I think the danger there is, I've seen them when I've been giving lectures there, I see a bit of institutionalization going on. People can just become insulated from the outside world. And my constant reference point is the likes of Johnny Doran, people who had to travel the hard roads and busk outside hurling matches with the pipes in the driving rain just to get a few pennies. To me, I always try and be mindful for that, how lucky we are, how far we have come from those point of view. But if it's one point I could make, there's been a lot of talk about money finances, but to me, right, character is another thing. The right to this, the right to that, irrespective of the finances. It mightn't necessarily be so important to me how many zeros are on the check, as Smilovich, the cellist, once said. How many zeros? But but it's the amount of money, the payment for a gig is one thing, but the conditions under which you have to do that gig is another thing. Like, is there a dressing room? Sorry, there isn't any dressing room. Change in the jacks, okay? That's a separate issue to money, the rights. I've got to do a television program. Oh, I've got to sign this piece of paper, which means I've got to sign away the copyright. I've got to sign away the moral rights. And moral rights are the right to be known as the author of your work. But more importantly, the second moral right, the integrity right, is the right that it will not be used in such a way to make a fool of you, or as they say, that your professional reputation isn't brought into disrepute. But the government of Ireland has given musicians certain rights under the Copyright and Related Rights Act 2000. And musicians should read that document, because when you go on television and you waive your rights, you just be aware of what you're waiving. And if you want to waive your rights, that's fine, so long as you make an informed choice. And people need to be aware of what they're doing if they're going to do that.
Coming out of the universities, a lot of young people are going through those courses and are being taught, presumably, to be aware of those things. But you do need to be aware.
I don't think so. I think there's a complete lack of awareness. There's two elements at play, and one is apathy. Irish, they're fine. Sign away to feck. Doesn't matter a damn. Let's have a few pints. And apathy. And number two is fear. Jez, I don't want to cause any trouble because I mightn't get any more gigs. And you don't want to be a troublemaker, or you don't give a damn. Apathy and fear are the two conjoined elements that mitigate against informed decision-making. And people need to be aware of what they're doing. and not be afraid to stand up. But the thing to get over the fear hurdle is collective action, because they will just wipe the floor with you when you one voice. But when there's 300 of you saying, no, we're not actually signing that, when there's 300 people in a united voice, they have to listen to you. And this is the most important thing to me for a traditional music in Ireland, an effective traditional musicians' union, independent from the Musicians' Union of Ireland, a union of people in a clever technological way that can act as a lobby group, and without membership fees, just acting through the force of petition and right on your side to argue for the case for fair contracts. That's my own particular beef, anyway.
So a collective voice which would give power to the person saying no, because if you say no and you're on your own, there's always 25 people behind you to fill that gap. And then the other thing is awareness. So obviously they're very important. But you are talking about with traditional music about some of the people involved are professional musicians for whom this is very important, and some people are just playing a few tunes on a Friday night, or it's for a hobby. Is that where it's not apathy? It's just it's different requirements for different groups within that sphere. Okay. Is that what it is?
Okay. Well, then there's a third element, which is social responsibility. I feel myself responsible to the next generation of traditional musicians to make it a better world for them than what we had. The battles we fought that the next generation don't have to fight it. When I see an established professional musician, a traditional musician who I respect and admire, when I see them sign a contract which I know takes away their rights, I say, well, actually, you're doing that for you, but don't you realize that when this 16-year-old kid says, I don't want to sign that, well, so-and-so signed it, do you think you're better than them? And they use that argument against the people who are fighting. You see, we all have a responsibility, not to just to ourselves, but to everybody else. And that's why we've really got to get informed and stand together.
Is it lack of confidence, Martin? Is that what it is? Or what is stopping people from sort of getting together in a collective voice to do something about things that are problematic?
Well, I think I should also mention that Steve does have an organization called FACE. Is it still?
So we started an organization called FACE, Philly, Arana, Hergis, Kjoltori, Naharan. And Cormac Brannock was one of the founding members, Leisha Kelly. And we were able to we fought three good campaigns in terms of television contracts, IMRO, they were making changes. We were able to use proxy votes on IMRO. We had about 300 members, but Martin was a member. We were able to do very effective work. But then the Musicians Union of Ireland started up, so we took a back seat then. We kind of dumped arms or stood down to let the Musicians Union give them a clear run to the field. But unfortunately, because the Musicians Union is associated with SIPTO, there are certain regulations that they must follow. And so we were more flexible and fluid. But there's talk about restarting it up, I don't know, or some new organization or reinvigorating FACE. But I know that we need some organization.
What do you think about that idea of a collective, of a union, Martin?
I think it sounds good to me. I mean, I think unions are something that, like, I think what Steve is saying there, there's an inflexibility to the changing world we're in, like that old union rules aren't able to accommodate, and maybe in the case of traditional music, there's peculiarities and particularities around that regular union organization wouldn't address. Yeah. So I think maybe there is an opening somewhere for something specifically oriented towards traditional music in terms of having a union, having an organization that kind of lays down some basic core understanding here, so that whenever we find ourselves in that situation, we say, well, you go to the website here and it actually shows you what we as a collection of musicians have agreed in respect to this, and there it is in black and white, so I won't sign that form. So, but I mean, I'm a little bit ignorant myself, because I came to the whole publishing thing really on the presumption that I own no music. And I basically discounted my own part of it as something that didn't require protection, like, in my own mind. I was just happy to play. But I would, like, the problem with those forms is that like you're just walking on the stage or on the set, and somebody comes from behind. Yeah. Oh, by the way, here. And so you're left with that option: create a scene right now,
exactly,
or sign it. Like, and I have to admit to having mostly signed it, Steve. I'm sorry, but and that's mainly because I just feel utterly unprepared to respond to it in that moment.
You make a very good point, because the person who is giving you the form doesn't even know what's in it. They've been told by their boss, get that musician to sign this form. And if you say, yes, but that says blah, 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 well, just sign the form, would you? So you actually have to take it up with the lawyer within that organization. So anyway, Shinskelele. But But also, if you do have an effective union, you have all the talents and gifts that each person has. They might teach fiddle, they might teach illum pipes, they might teach that. So if you're a parent looking for an illum pipe teacher for your child in Carlo, zip onto the union website. Oh, pipers in Carlo, blah, 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 blah. I know the Pipers Club will have a thing, but, you know, it's this collectivization of talent. And once you have that, you can channel that to a multiplicity of...
So it's a centralization of advice, of the collective voice, so that people can...
Yeah, and you can establish confidential talking shops within that.
Yeah.
And public face and private face, yeah.
I mean, one thing that struck me from the speakers we heard earlier is also that you can't... musicians also have a responsibility themselves. I mean, it was interesting to hear people say that applications aren't coming in for money that's there or for residencies that's there. So, you know, you were saying people need to make themselves aware of the clauses on contracts, what they mean, what your moral rights are, what rights you have in terms of copyright, all of those things. And also the funding that is out there that you should be getting, and make sure that you go get it. You know, that's important, because why did the Hawkswell, for example, not get enough applications in the case that was spoken about earlier?
That's a very good point, because if you have this collectivization, you'll find talented people who love doing applications, and you get a load of musicians who can't cope with doing applications. But it's a way of bringing people together. And so this person can advertise their service. I will do your application for you. Send me your CV. Blah, 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 blah.
Okay, look, we're nearly out of time, so I'm going to go through the rapid-fire round. Should there be an Aist Donna type of organisation for musicians?
Yes, I think we're using the word artist here a lot today, but it's only technically creative artists, and that's a definition. So performing artists don't have a place in Aist Donna, and I think there's every good reason why some musicians and performers should have either be in Aist Donna or have an equivalent organisation that handles areas for dance and for theatre and for actors and for musicians, performers. And because just like writers and other people, a lot of what they do isn't necessarily commercial in the normal sense, and they have great difficulty in surviving also. So I think there should be something for them, yeah.
And is it time, I mean, maybe this ties into what you were saying, Steve, but is it time for somewhere like a traditional music headquarters, you know, a gathering place, a venue, an advice centre, maybe a library, something like that? Should there be something like that, like a cultural institute for traditional music?
Well, I would like to say something on the last question, like Aist Donna, because there's only one traditional musician in Aist Donna, Don Lunny. There was Tommy Peoples, was until he passed away. But you have to be a composer of music, so that's the kind of thing. But the Japanese have a model of the national living treasure. So if you're contributing to culture, the culture of your nation, you're awarded bursaries and stuff like that. So that could possibly be a good model. But you're talking about a physical infrastructure, are you there, Eva? Mm. Yeah. Even a digital infrastructure would be good, because it doesn't cost anything.
Well, look, it's been a pleasure talking to both of you today. I think we could stay here a lot longer, but I would be very reluctant to let you both go without some more music. And Steve, I know that you have just recently finished a project on harp music. So before you play a tune together, would you play us one of your harp tunes on guitar?
I might have to tune up.
You can talk about music, but it's nice to hear music, I think.
Well, I mean, the guitar is often seen as an accompanying instrument. And I know I have several bees in my bonnet, but that's one of them, that the guitar is well able to play tunes. Well, a good... So I've been exploring the harp music, and with the hope that guitarists will play tunes more on the guitar rather than see themselves as So, this is... I see a book there, Kathleen Lochnan's book on the Harper's Conlon, or Connellan, as it's they're sometimes called. This is by Tom Conlon. Connellan? Conlon. Well, I had a gig... He's from Clun na Mahan in South Sligo, so I had a gig in Sligo, and I asked them, how do you say it round here, Connellan or Conlon? Well, there's an awful lot of Conlons round here, they said, so... Cecilia Conlon. I only recorded it because Martin kicked my butt about 2 years ago. Said, "Would you ever just go into the studio and put the tunes down with
fair play, Martin?" Yeah. And thanks a million, Steve.
It's very beautiful when people do eventually get to hear this album, which I have heard. It's extraordinary. So anyway, looking forward to it.
Oh, gur mila mila mahagi asocht velin Erin Rolling Wave and yo agus gur mahagi trad Ireland asocht an quire a ve and sho Erin Law sho ta me sugamorle fekal. Conosairian live agus na multi-bager hagan own law. So Gurmagi, we're going to leave you with a tune from Steve Cooney and Martin Hayes, and I'm not sure what they're playing.
So one of Martin's compositions?
Well, no, the first one is called Young Tom Ennis, and the second one is called The Mahara Mountains.
By Martin Hayes.
Yeah, mark that down. I'm not signing off on that.
Yeah, you get a few more royalties.
Martin Hayes on fiddle and Steve Cooney on guitar there from the Trad Talk conference recorded in Dublin Castle. Well, thanks again for listening to RT Radio 1's The Rolling Wave podcast. For rights reasons, the music here is shorter than in the original broadcast. So if you want to hear the full version, just visit the Rolling Wave homepage on rte.ie/Radio 1. This programme was first broadcast on the 23rd of February 2020. Till the next time, Gur Míle Maithí agus slán. Thank you.